Welcome to the History Maps podcast.
It's 1592.
A seasoned Japanese infantryman stands on the wooden deck of a transport ship heading toward the Korean coast.
Right. He has spent his entire life fighting in grueling land wars.
He is heavily armored, carrying a razor-sharp katana, and his commanders expect an easy boarding action against the Hoseon Navy.
But then, emerging through the coastal fog comes something he has literally no frame of reference for.
It's a massive, flat-bottomed ship roaring right toward his fleet.
It has no open deck for him to jump onto.
It's spewing toxic, choking sulfur smoke from a carved dragon's head at the bow.
And before he can even raise his musket, this floating fortress begins firing 9-foot-long wooden missiles that completely shatter his transport ship into splinters.
Today, we're entirely deconstructing that machine. The Geobuxian, which is widely known as the Korean turtle ship.
It was a highly specialized solution, engineered to counter a very specific type of warfare.
So our objective for this deep dive isn't just to list off historical dates. We want to move past the popularized myths and examine the highly specialized engineering, the unique weaponry, and the tactical applications that allowed the Hoseon Navy to dominate their coastal waters during the Imjin War from 1592 to 1598.
To get to the truth of how this vessel operated, we're relying on some highly detailed primary accounts.
Which sources are we primarily looking at?
The most vital one is Admiral Yi Sun-sin's personal war diary, the Nanjung Ilgi, which gives us a day-by-day look at the conflict.
Okay, so a direct primary account.
Exactly. And we're pairing that with the annals of the Joseon Dynasty, modern naval reconstructions, and North Korean technical specifications to build an accurate picture of its capabilities.
For you listening, we want to look at this deep dive as an exploration of how a highly specific problem, which was a massive naval invasion, was met with an equally specific, heavily engineered solution.
But to grasp how effective the Geobuxian was, we first need to completely understand the problem it was trying to solve.
Right, we have to look at the naval landscape and the exact nature of the Japanese threat at the end of the 16th century.
Context is absolutely vital here. So if we look at the Japanese forces in 1592, we have to recognize what they had just been through.
They had just emerged from the Sengoku period.
Yes, which was a century of nearly continuous, brutal, internal civil war.
Basically 100 years of fighting on land.
Exactly. They had refined infantry tactics, fortress sieges, and battlefield maneuvers.
So the men boarding those ships were seasoned, battle-hardened veterans.
They were, but when Toyotomi Hideyoshi unified Japan and decided to launch an invasion into the Asian mainland, with Korea as the first step, he had to move hundreds of thousands of those veteran troops across the sea.
And reading through the historical accounts of how they fought on the water, it struck me that they didn't really have a naval strategy in the way we usually think of one.
No, not really.
They fought on the water like they were still fighting on a dusty battlefield.
That's the core of their naval doctrine. They applied a strict land warfare mentality to naval combat.
Which is an interesting way to approach a maritime invasion.
Well, to the Japanese commanders, ships were not independent fighting platforms designed to sink other ships.
Right.
They viewed their vessels essentially as floating transport platforms.
So the entire goal was simply to deliver their greatest martial asset, which was their expert samurai swordsmen and bowmen, into striking range of the enemy.
Which perfectly explains their ship design. The primary Japanese ships utilized in the invasion were broad-beamed armed transports.
Built to maximize trip capacity.
Exactly. They weren't building galleons designed to trade heavy artillery broadsides.
Right. They had very little naval tradition focused on heavy artillery, from what the sources indicate.
A typical Japanese transport might mount only one or two small cannons, if any at all.
So because they lacked heavy guns, their entire combat sequence was highly predictable.
Predictable, yes. But we must also note, it was highly lethal if executed correctly.
How did a standard engagement actually play out for them?
Their strategy was always to close the distance. They would row their transports toward the enemy vessel as quickly as possible.
Just charging straight in?
Basically. Once they were within range, they didn't try to sink the enemy ship. Instead, they would rake the enemy deck with concentrated, overwhelming arrow fire and volleys from their smoothbore muskets, the arquebus.
The objective being to just force the enemy crew to take cover or kill anyone standing on the top deck.
Yes. They needed to clear the defenders from the rails.
And once that suppressive fire had cleared the enemy deck,
Then the Japanese ships would close the final few yards. They would throw grappling hooks, pull the ships tight against each other, and the infantry would swarm over the rails for close quarters combat.
Which was obviously their absolute specialty.
Once it became a hand-to-hand fight on a wooden deck, the Japanese infantry, particularly the samurai, were largely unmatched.
This sounds exactly like a medieval siege.
It really does.
The Japanese were essentially using their ships as floating siege towers, pushing them right up against the walls of the enemy vessels to deliver their infantry over the ramparts.
That's a highly accurate way to frame it. And even if we look at their largest ships, the Atakabune, this philosophy holds true.
The Atakabunes are notable because some historical records mention they were occasionally clad in iron plates.
Yeah, sometimes.
But the trade-off for that armor was massive. They were exceedingly sluggish and restricted strictly to coastal operations.
The Atakabune were literally floating castles. They had multi-story wooden superstructures meant to serve as command posts and heavy infantry platforms.
But deeply unseaworthy for open ocean combat.
Yes, and incredibly slow to maneuver. The vast majority of the Japanese armada consisted of the lighter, faster transports to get the infantry into the fight.
So we can look at this from the perspective of a Huzian sailor standing on the deck of a standard patrol ship, observing this armada approaching.
It wouldn't look like a naval fleet intending to exchange broadsides.
No, it would look like a swarm of transport vessels, bristling with thousands of muskets and grappling hooks, moving with the singular intent of turning the water into a hand-to-hand land battle.
For a traditional navy, it was a very severe scenario. The sheer volume of infantry they could deliver was overwhelming.
So the Hoseon commanders quickly realized that trying to fight the Japanese in a traditional boarding action was a losing proposition.
Exactly. The Hoseon Navy needed a vessel that was fundamentally unboardable.
Okay, so you need a ship that completely nullifies the enemy's only real tactic. This brings us to the genesis of the turtle design.
Right.
Because to solve this immediate crisis, the Koreans actually looked backward into their own history. The concept of a covered ship wasn't entirely new in 1592, was it?
Not at all. The idea had existed in various forms for centuries.
Where do we first see it?
We can trace the lineage of covered ships back to the 9th century with Zhang Bogo of the Silla Dynasty.
Okay, so way back.
Yes. He operated a massive maritime network from his military base at Chianghaijin. He utilized early versions of shell-covered ships to dominate East Asian trade routes and, crucially, to suppress piracy.
Ah, because pirates also rely entirely on boarding tactics.
Exactly. If you want to stop a pirate, you build a ship they can't climb into.
It makes perfect sense.
Moving forward, the historical records in the annals of the Joseon Dynasty are quite precise about the first true generation of turtle ships, specifically called Guizhian.
Right. The records note specific dates, 1417 and 1415, during the reigns of King Tojong and King Sejong.
The annals describe the king witnessing mock battles involving these Guizhian fighting against Japanese-style ships.
So even in the early 15th century, they clearly recognized the utility of a heavily covered ship designed specifically to counter the tactics of Japanese raiders and pirates along the coast.
They did. But then, after those early 15th century records, the design seemingly falls into total obscurity.
Right. There was a long period of relative peace on the peninsula, and the turtle ships vanished from the active naval roster.
Which is a common pattern in military history.
It raises a big question for me, though. If you have a ship that works perfectly against your primary regional rival, why would you just stop building it?
It comes down to the economic reality of maintaining highly specialized military technology during peacetime.
Ah, it's a budget issue.
Exactly. Covered warships are incredibly expensive to build. They require more timber, they are heavier, and the maintenance of a specialized closed deck structure is far more labor-intensive than a standard open deck patrol boat.
So when the immediate threat goes away, the budget gets slashed.
As happens in almost every era. When the threat of heavy piracy or invasion recedes, military budgets contract.
Right. And the most specialized, expensive tools are always the first to be decommissioned.
A standard patrol boat can do customs work and light policing much more cheaply than a massive, heavily armored Guizhian.
That makes practical sense. But eventually, the threat returned. Enter Admiral Yi Sun Sin and his chief constructor, Not Dae Young.
Right. In 1591, anticipating Toyotomi Hideyoshi's massive invasion, they rapidly revived and heavily modified the old Guizhian design.
They understood the intelligence coming out of Japan.
Yes. They recognized that the impending invasion would rely on exactly the boarding tactics the Guizhian was originally designed to counter.
But they didn't just pull the 15th century blueprints and recreate the old ship.
No, they fundamentally upgraded it. They transformed it from a simple, covered anti-piracy boat into a heavily armed, highly maneuverable artillery platform.
And the timeline they operated on is striking. Yeah. We're looking at a state of absolute emergency.
The records note that the heavy cannons for the new turtle ship were tested on March 12, 1592.
And the very first completed vessel was launched on March 27, 1592.
That is mere weeks before the Japanese invasion began in April.
The margin for error was virtually zero.
This was rapid prototyping, testing, and deployment born out of absolute necessity. If Nade Young's design had possessed a fatal flaw, there would have been no time to correct it before the war began.
So let's talk about that design and look at the engineering of the hull and propulsion.
Right.
If you are going to carry heavy armor, a thick roof, and massive cannons, you can't just slap all of that onto a standard fishing boat. You need a very specific foundation.
You do. But notably, they didn't try to design a completely new hull shape from scratch, which would have taken years of testing.
Oh, really?
No, the Geobuxion was built upon the standard Shoseon workhorse warship, the Panoxion.
So they adapted an existing base.
Yes. And this was a crucial logistical decision because it utilized existing shipbuilding infrastructure, timber supplies, and the knowledge of local shipwrights.
I was looking at the hydrodynamics of this hull shape, and this is where things get really mechanically interesting.
It's a very distinct design.
We have to contrast the Korean U-shaped flat-bottomed hull with the V-shaped hulls that were common in European galleons and many Japanese ships at the time.
The difference in hull shape dictates exactly how a ship can fight. A V-shaped hull, which tapers down to a sharp keel, acts like a knife in the water.
Right.
It cuts through deep ocean swells very efficiently, providing speed and stability for long open ocean voyages.
But the drawback is the draft and the turning radius.
Correct. A V-shaped hull sits deep in the water, meaning it can easily run aground in shallows. And when you want to turn a V-hull, it requires a long, wide, sweeping arc.
You can't just spin it.
Exactly. The U-shaped, flat-bottomed hull of the Canoxian and the Geobuxian operates on a completely different physical principle. It sits much higher in the water.
It has a shallow draft, which is perfect for the jagged coastlines, tidal flats, and shallow straits of the Korean Peninsula.
But the real combat advantage is the rotational capability.
Yes, the flat bottom allowed the ship to essentially spin in place.
By coordinating the oarsmen rowing forward on the port side and backward on the starboard side, the entire ship could rotate on its own central axis.
It's exactly like a modern zero-turn lawnmower or a hovercraft.
That's a good way to picture it.
You are intentionally sacrificing straight line, open ocean speed for the ability to rotate completely in place.
And in the middle of a chaotic naval battle, that capability is a massive force multiplier.
Because you can unleash a devastating barrage from your starboard cannons, spin the ship 180 degrees in a matter of seconds, and instantly bring a fresh line of loaded portside cannons to bear on the exact same target.
That rotational speed was absolutely devastating against the Japanese ships, which were forced to take long, wide arcs to bring their sides around. The Geobuxian could just dance around them in the shallow waters.
As for the scale of these vessels, the dimensions are substantial. The sources show we are talking about ships typically 100 to 120 feet long, so 30 to 37 meters.
And they were roughly 38 feet wide. They utilized a strict 3-to-1 keel-to-beam ratio.
What does that ratio achieve?
This wide stance on the flat bottom provided an incredibly stable firing platform, meaning the heavy cannons wouldn't capsize the ship when fired simultaneously.
The materials used for this construction were also incredibly robust. They used red pine planks up to 120 millimeters thick.
That's nearly 5 inches of solid, dense wood for the hull.
Red pine is notoriously heavy and dense, and it's highly resistant to rot, making it ideal for a warship hull. But the joining method is what truly sets the Korean shipbuilding apart.
The joining method is fascinating.
This was something I found initially confusing. Instead of using iron nails, which were standard in Europe and many other parts of the world, Korean shipwrights used wooden nails or pegs to hold these massive pine planks together.
I know. At first glance, using wood instead of iron seems like a step backward.
Right. If I'm building a warship meant to smash into things, I want thick iron bolts holding it together.
That's the intuitive thought, because iron seems stronger. But iron on a wooden ship in salt water introduces a fatal flaw, rust.
Oh, of course.
Iron rusts when exposed to seawater, and as it rusts, it degrades, bleeding into the wood and eventually causing the joint to fail.
So it's a longevity issue.
It's longevity, but it's also about kinetic physics. Iron does not yield. It is rigid.
Okay.
When a ship fires a heavy black powder cannon, or when it physically rams another massive wooden vessel, the kinetic shock ripples violently through the entire hull structure.
And rigid iron nails can actually shear or snap under that sudden violent stress.
Exactly. Wooden pegs, on the other hand, possess a slight natural elasticity. They absorb the shock rather than fighting it.
And there's an interaction with the water, right?
Yes. When these dense wooden nails are exposed to seawater, the wood absorbs the moisture and physically expands.
So the nails actually swell up inside the holes.
Exactly. This expansion creates an incredibly tight, rust-proof, permanently locked joint.
It actually strengthens the hull over time as the ship sits in the water.
Which was an absolute necessity for a ship designed specifically to absorb the massive, repeated shock of ramming tactics and heavy cannon recoil.
That is a brilliant piece of localized engineering, using the environment to strengthen the machine.
It really is.
Now, to move this massive, heavy, 5-inch-thick pine structure, the propulsion system had to be extensive.
The records show they utilized between 14 to 20 oars, manned by roughly 70 to 80 oarsmen.
That's 2 to 4 men hauling on a single oar.
Plus, they had 2 lowerable masts with sails.
The dual propulsion system was key to their operational flexibility.
Right. The sails were strictly used for transit to get from the naval base to the staging area, giving them speeds up to 8 knots.
But once combat was imminent, leaving the masts up was a liability.
Because they could catch an unfavorable wind or provide a target for enemy fire.
So the masts were physically lowered flat against the deck to reduce the ship's profile.
During actual battle, propulsion was entirely human-powered. The oarsmen could drive the heavy ship at speeds of 4 to 7 knots on oars alone.
And all of this heavy structure, the cannons, the dense pine, the massive crew, it required careful balancing.
The technical specs note a very low center of gravity. The weight center of the entire ship was just 1.5 meters from the bottom of the hull.
This is a critical engineering detail. It provided a massive restoring force.
A heavy, enclosed ship with heavy brass and iron cannons mounted high up runs a severe risk of capsizing in rough water or during tight maneuvers.
By keeping the ballast and the heavy structural weight as low as possible in that flat U-hole, the Geoboxian possessed immense stability.
It prevented the ship from rolling over even when executing those sharp zero-turn rotations or absorbing the physical impact of a ramming maneuver.
Okay, so we have a heavily built, highly maneuverable, highly stable base. Now we have to move to the defining feature of the ship.
The element that makes it the turtle ship.
Exactly. We're talking about the enclosed roof designed explicitly to neutralize the Japanese boarding tactics.
The carapace. This is the visual and tactical signature of the Geoboxian.
The curved upper deck was fully enclosed, built from the same robust, 4-inch-thick wooden planks as the lower hull.
And the anti-boarding measures they implemented were brutally straightforward. The entire surface of the curved roof was studded with sharp iron spikes or awls.
Which brings us directly to one of the longest-standing historical debates surrounding this vessel.
Right. Was the Geoboxian a true ironclad?
Was it covered entirely in hexagonal iron plates, as you often see in popular depictions?
It's a very persistent visual myth.
It is everywhere. Half the illustrations in history books or museums show the ship entirely plated in interlocking iron armor.
Looking almost like a 19th century dreadnought or a submarine.
Yeah. But if we look closely at the primary sources, the people who actually saw, built, and commanded these ships, the evidence refuting full iron cladding is substantial and very consistent.
It is. Let's break down what those primary sources actually say.
Let's do it.
First, we have Admiral Yi Sun Sin's own nephew, Yi Bun. He wrote a detailed posthumous account of his uncle's life and military campaigns.
And what does he note?
In his writings, he explicitly recorded the roof of the ship as being made of wooden planks. He mentions no solid iron plates.
Interesting.
Furthermore, we have the records of Prime Minister Yu Song-yong, who oversaw much of the war effort. He also reported that the ships were covered by wooden planks on top.
And what about Yi Sun Sin himself? Did he write about iron armor in the Nanjong Ilgi?
He did not. Yu Sun Sin's own diaries meticulously mention iron spikes being planted into the top deck to deter boarders, but there is absolutely no mention of forging or mounting solid iron plates to cover the wood.
Beyond the textual evidence, looking at the economics of the time really drives the point home for me.
The cost would have been staggering.
The historical records state that outfitting a single ship with the estimated 6 tons of iron plating required to cover the roof would cost the equivalent of building an entirely new second ship.
It would have been an astronomical misallocation of scarce resources during a time of total war.
Iron was precious.
They needed it for cannon barrels, for the spikes, for weapons. To waste 6 tons of it covering a roof would have crippled their shipbuilding budget.
And if we step back and look at the bigger picture, why would they even need thick iron plating?
Right.
We already established that the Japanese transports had almost no ship-mounted cannons. Their primary range weapons were arrows and the smoothbore musket.
Exactly. 5 inches of solid, dense red pine is more than sufficient to stop a 16th century lead musket ball.
The ball would simply embed itself in the wood.
Heavy iron plating would have been entirely redundant against the weapons the Japanese were actually firing.
Plus, adding 6 tons of iron to the highest point of the ship would completely ruin that low center of gravity we just talked about.
It would severely compromise the ship's buoyancy, make it incredibly top-heavy, and destroy the speed and maneuverability they needed.
So where did the myth come from?
The ironclad myth didn't actually originate during the Imjin War. It largely grew from 19th century Western records and early 20th century interpretation.
Oh, so much later.
Yes, when Western historians first learned the ship and its dominance, they often mistranslated or misinterpreted the phrase iron-spiked as ironclad.
They were trying to draw parallels to their own early ironclad ships, like the USS Monitor.
They assumed that a ship this successful must have had iron armor.
But the historical reality of the wooden roof covered with iron spikes is arguably more ingenious, especially when you look at the tactical camouflage they used.
The camouflage is a fascinating aspect.
The records mention that the iron spikes weren't just left gleaming in the sun. They were often intentionally concealed beneath layers of thatch or wet rice mats.
This was a layer of calculated psychological warfare.
I was wondering about this. Why hide the spikes?
It seems counterintuitive.
Right. If your entire goal is to deter enemy soldiers from boarding your ship, wouldn't you want them to clearly see the massive, deadly iron spikes so they know to stay away?
It comes down to how you control the enemy's behavior in combat. If the Japanese samurai saw the spikes clearly, they might try to adapt.
They might try to carefully navigate between them.
Or they might focus their concerted musket fire on a specific area to try and blast the spikes away and clear a safe path to board.
Right. If they see the obstacle, they can try to solve it.
But by hiding the spikes beneath commonplace thatch or rice mats, the Hoseian commanders created a deadly illusion of vulnerability.
In the heat of battle, through the fog and the smoke, the thatch made the roof look like a normal, flat, safe surface.
It actively invited the Japanese infantry to employ their standard tactic. They would throw their hooks, pull the ship close, and confidently jump down onto what looked like a soft mat,
resulting in immediate, horrific impalement.
It is a brutal but highly effective deterrent.
Once the first wave of elite boarders met that fate, screaming and trapped on the hidden spikes, the psychological impact on the rest of the Japanese fleet watching from their transports was paralyzing.
In an instant, their entire doctrine of boarding was rendered entirely suicidal.
They couldn't board, and they didn't have the cannons to sink the Geo-Buxen from a distance.
They were completely neutralized.
But defense alone does not win battles. The Geo-Buxen was not just a spiked shield meant to sit in the water and absorb attacks. It was a highly mobile artillery battery.
Designed for 360-degree devastation.
The offensive capabilities were just as specialized and heavily engineered as the defensive carapace. We have to look at the massive armament they managed to pack into this hull.
The records indicate a typical Geo-Buxen carried between 24 and 40 cannons per ship.
That is an incredible density of firepower for a 16th century vessel of that size.
And they weren't just firing out of the sides. They had gun ports engineered into all 4 sides of the ship.
Because the Shoshin Navy had spent centuries studying and refining gunpowder weapons.
Originally deriving their knowledge from 14th century Chinese gunpowder technology, by the time of the Imjin War, they had developed a highly sophisticated tiered system of naval artillery.
Let's break down that artillery. They had several distinct classes of cannons on board.
They did. For maximum destructive power, you had the heavy Chianja cannons, which translates to heaven.
These were the largest guns.
Yes, possessing a maximum range of roughly 600 meters. They were primarily used for heavy structural damage at closer ranges.
And then there were the Huangzha, or yellow cannons,
which were slightly smaller caliber but designed for longer range engagements, capable of reaching targets up to 1,300 meters away.
And for closer range, anti-personnel fire, they used the Sunzha.
The Sunzha were essentially heavy mounted arquebuses. They had a range of about 200 meters and were devastating against the tightly packed Japanese infantry on the decks of their transports.
But while the cannons themselves are significant, what really stands out is the unique ammunition they used in those heavy Qianzha and Wangzha cannons.
They fired something called the Jangfion.
And the Jangfion completely defies traditional European naval expectations.
It does. When we think of naval cannons, we think of round iron balls smashing into wooden hulls.
The Jangfion were not round iron balls. They were massive aerodynamic wooden missiles.
The dimensions on these are staggering. We are talking about projectiles that were up to 3.6 meters long.
That is a 9-foot-long wooden log, eventually a giant arrow being fired out of a heavy cannon.
They featured heavy iron tips for penetration and leather stabilizing flights at the back, just like a normal arrow.
The physics behind this choice of ammunition is fascinating. Why fire a giant wooden arrow instead of a heavy, solid iron ball?
First, there's the gunpowder efficiency. A wooden arrow, even a 9-foot one, is significantly lighter than a solid iron ball of the same diameter.
Therefore, it requires significantly less black powder to propel it out of the barrel at high velocity,
which saves precious resources during a long war.
But second, because of those leather stabilizing flights, the Jangfion does just tumble through the air.
It flies straight. It possesses incredibly high aerodynamic accuracy.
And what happens when a 9-foot wooden arrow flying at cannon velocity hits a ship?
It possesses immense, specialized penetrating power. Again, we must remember the design of the Japanese ships.
They were broad-beam transports made of relatively thin wood.
Designed for holding troops, not for withstanding heavy artillery fire.
If you fire a standard round iron ball at a thin wooden hull, the ball will often punch a relatively clean round hole straight through the wood.
And a ship's carpenter can sometimes plug a round hole quickly, but a 9-foot iron-tipped wooden missile operates differently.
When it strikes, it doesn't just punch a hole. The massive wooden shaft acts as a wedge.
It violently shatters the hull planking, splinters the internal structural ribs, and then embeds itself deep inside the ship.
It causes catastrophic structural failure across a wide area of the hull, rather than just a localized puncture.
It is a weapon perfectly tailored to exploit the specific structural vulnerabilities of the enemy's transport ships. It tears them apart from the inside out.
And then, beyond the cannons on the sides and the massive wooden arrows, we have the most iconic offensive feature of the entire ship, the massive carved dragon's head at the bow.
The dragon's head is often thought of as merely a decorative figurehead designed to look fearsome.
But in the Geobuxian, it was a highly functional piece of military hardware.
First, it housed a cannon directly inside its mouth,
providing direct forward firing capability.
Yes, ensuring there were absolutely no blind spots in the ship's artillery coverage as it advanced on the enemy.
Furthermore, the structural head itself and the heavy neck supporting it were heavily reinforced with dense timber to act as a physical battering ram.
But the chemical warfare aspect is what truly elevates the dragon's head from a simple ram into a terror weapon.
The historical records note that the dragon's head contained a specialized tube that burned a mixture of sulfur and saltpeter,
emitting a dense, toxic smoke screen directly out of the mouth.
This raises a very important tactical point about how the ship fought. The smoke wasn't just for show.
No, it served multiple vital functions simultaneously in the heat of battle.
It's highly comparable to modern naval countermeasures, like a destroyer popping smoke to hide from missiles.
Or even a biological equivalent, like a squid spraying ink to confuse a predator.
That's an apt comparison. When the Geobuxian approached a dense cluster of Japanese transports, it would ignite this mixture.
The thick, toxic sulfur smoke would billow out, physically blinding the enemy fleet. It masked the Geobuxian's exact movements and heading.
And it causes choking chaos in the Japanese ranks right before a ramming impact.
Exactly. The Japanese infantry are coughing, their eyes are burning, they can't see the massive spiked roof coming at them.
And they can't coordinate their musket fire.
It completely disrupted their ability to organize any kind of defense or counterattack in the final crucial seconds before the Geobuxians smash into their hulls.
Okay, so we have all these distinct engineering features. We have the flat U-hull for spinning, the spiked roof hidden by thatch, the heavy cannons firing 9-foot wooden missiles, and a ramming dragon's head spewing toxic smoke.
It's a lot of specialized equipment.
How did all of these elements coalesce into a cohesive battle doctrine? We need to look at the tactical deployment of the ship and how this vanguard operated in action.
To understand its tactical deployment, we first must clarify the operational role of the Geobixian within the wider Joseon Navy.
Right, because it is a very common historical misconception that Yi Sun Sin commanded entire fleets made up entirely of turtle ships.
The numbers clearly show they were relatively rare. It was never the main ship of the line.
The Panoxians, the standard open-deck warships, always formed the main battle line.
They provided the sheer volume of long-range artillery support needed to win a massive engagement. The Geobuxian served a very different, highly specialized role.
It was the shock assault vessel.
It was the heavily armored tip of the spear.
So walk us through the standard assault sequence. If Yi Sun Sin signals an attack, what does the Geobuxian actually do?
The standard assault tactic maximized every single one of its unique features in a rapid sequence.
Okay.
Upon engagement, a Geobuxian, powered by its 80 oarsmen, would rapidly row directly into the center of the dense Japanese fleet formation,
leaving the main Joseon fleet behind to provide cover fire.
Yes. As the Geobuxian closed the final distance, it would unleash the sulfur smoke from the dragon's head to blind the enemy and mask its final approach.
It plunges right into the middle of the enemy formation.
Once inside, surrounded by Japanese transports, the crew utilizes that flat U-hull.
The zero-turn maneuver.
They spin the ship rapidly in place, firing the Cheonja and Hwangja cannons in consecutive, devastating broadsides at point-blank range.
They are blasting 9-foot wooden arrows in all directions.
And while the Japanese troops are blinded by smoke, choking on sulfur, and taking heavy cannon fire from a spinning fortress they can't board,
the Geobuxian executes its final move.
It physically rams the fragile Japanese transports. It uses that reinforced dragon's head and the dense pine hull to physically shatter the thin wooden sides of the enemy ships.
It's a doctrine of total localized disruption.
Precisely. By aggressively breaking the Japanese formation, destroying their transports, and rendering their boarding tactics impossible, the Geobuxian created chaos.
It tied up the Japanese fleet,
allowing the main fleet of Joseon Panoxians to maintain a safe distance and methodically pick off the disorganized, panicking Japanese ships with long-range artillery.
The Battle of Hansando, which took place in July of 1592, seems to be the textbook example of this doctrine working perfectly.
Hansando is a masterclass in naval strategy, and it clearly demonstrates the necessary synergy between the ship's engineering capabilities and a commander's strategic vision.
Admiral Yi Sun Sin used a brilliant bait-and-switch tactic to lure a superior Japanese fleet into the confined waters of Hansen Bay.
He understood the local geography and the tidal currents of Hansen Bay perfectly.
He sent a small detachment of ships out to provoke the Japanese fleet, feigning a retreat to lure them into the wider expanse of the bay.
And once the Japanese fleet aggressively pursued them into the bay, thinking they had the upper hand, Yi Sun Sin unleashed the Hagikjin.
The Hagikjin, or the crane wing formation.
As the Japanese fleet entered the kill zone, the main Joseon fleet, which had been hiding behind nearby islands, rode out and formed a massive U-shape, the wings of a crane.
This formation completely enveloped the advancing Japanese fleet.
The Panoxians on the wings caught the Japanese transports in a devastating crossfire,
while the Geobuxians plunged straight into the center to cause chaos, ram ships, and break any attempt by the Japanese to organize a concentrated countercharge.
The result was an absolute slaughter. The Joseon forces sank between 59 and 73 Japanese vessels that day, with minimal losses of their own.
It was a decisive, crushing victory that effectively halted the Japanese naval advance along the southern coast and severed their vital supply lines.
But we have to contrast the success at Hansando with the Battle of Chilkyolyang.
Right, because as effective as the Geobuxian was, it wasn't a magic win button that guaranteed victory regardless of who was at the helm.
The Battle of Chilkyolyang in 1597 is a tragic but vital counterpoint.
Due to severe political machinations and factional strife at the royal court, Admiral Yi Sun Sin was falsely accused of insubordination, tortured, and temporarily removed from command.
His rival, Won Kyun, was appointed as the supreme commander of the naval forces.
And Won Kyun inherited this incredible fleet, including the turtle ships, but he deployed them without understanding the proper tactics.
Won Kyun was pressured by the court to launch an aggressive offensive, and he pushed the fleet into action without the meticulous planning Yi Sun Sin was known for.
He ignored the vital local currents, he didn't scout the enemy effectively, and he failed to utilize the baiting tactics necessary to draw the Japanese into favorable terrain.
He essentially rode a tired, exhausted fleet directly into a Japanese ambush in an area where they couldn't maneuver.
The fleet was caught in a highly disadvantageous position, penned in a narrow strait where the superior maneuverability of the flat-bottom U-hulls was nullified.
They couldn't form the crane wing, and the Geobuxions were swarmed and overwhelmed.
The result was a devastating defeat. The Hosa Navy was nearly annihilated in a single night, and the deployed turtle ships were lost.
This emphasizes a crucial historical point. The technology, no matter how advanced, was not invulnerable on its own.
The Geobuxion required the specific strategic mastery of a commander like Yi Sun Sin, someone who intimately understood maneuvering, timing, wind, and local currents.
Without the right commander utilizing the correct doctrine, even the best technology failed catastrophically.
Technology is only ever as effective as the doctrine and the leadership guiding its use.
A hammer is useless if you try to use it as a saw.
I do have one lingering question about the tactical deployment, specifically regarding the ramming tactics.
Sure.
Weren't these covered ships incredibly expensive and resource-intensive to build?
They were.
Wasn't it an immense risk to take this highly valuable asset and purposefully smash it into enemy vessels in physical collisions?
They were immensely expensive, representing a massive investment of timber, iron, and skilled labor. However, we have to look back at the engineering.
Right, the construction.
The robust red pine construction, the 5-inch thick hull, the low center of gravity, and specifically the expanding wooden nails were all purpose-built to deliver and absorb this exact type of kinetic energy.
So it wasn't a desperate move. It was a calculated function of the design.
It was a highly calculated, acceptable risk. The damage inflicted on a lightly built Japanese transport by a heavy Geobuxion ramming. It was catastrophic and immediate for the Japanese.
While the Geobuxion, on the other hand, was structurally designed to survive that exact impact, reset, and do it again.
So it was a highly effective use of their armored asset while they had it.
This leads us to the aftermath, the eventual obsolescence, and the legacy of the ship.
Despite an unbroken record of 23 naval victories under Yi Sun Sin, the Geobuxion eventually faded from the seas.
We need to examine why this highly effective, war-winning weapon became obsolete.
We have to look at the post-war strategic environment. After the Japanese forces finally retreated in 1598, following the death of Hideyoshi, the entire dynamic in the region changed drastically.
The specific existential threat of massive fleet-to-fleet boarding parties disappeared almost overnight.
Exactly. The Geobuxion was an extreme, expensive solution engineered for an extreme, specific problem.
Once the threat of massive Japanese boarding actions was removed, the utility of a heavy, slow-moving, enclosed assault ship plummeted.
And we should note the sheer numbers involved. Because they were so iconic, people assumed there were hundreds of them.
But they were never mass-produced. The records indicate there were only a handful active during the Imjin War itself.
Estimates range from a mere 3 to 12 active vessels at any one time under Yi Sun Sin's command.
They were always a rare, specialized asset. Interestingly, the numbers did peak later during peacetime.
By 1770, under King Yongzhou, the fleet maintained roughly 40 vessels, largely as a deterrent and a symbol of naval pride.
But after that, the numbers steadily declined. Because by the 19th century, changing naval warfare dynamics rendered them entirely impractical.
Naval technology advanced globally. The 19th century brought the standardization of heavy, explosive naval artillery and high-velocity rifled cannons.
And a 4-inch wooden roof, even one covered in iron spikes, provides absolutely no defense against an explosive shell designed to detonate inside a hull.
Or a high-velocity cannonball that can punch through a foot of solid oak.
The era of close-quarters boarding as a primary naval tactic was over, and thus the era of the Geobuxion ended.
And unfortunately for modern historians, there is a complete lack of physical remains.
Because they were built entirely of wood and iron, no original turtle ships exist anywhere in the world today.
It is a profound tragedy for marine archaeologists. Wood decays rapidly in highly oxygenated seawater.
Unless a ship is quickly buried in deep anaerobic mud, shipworms and rot will consume it within a century.
We have had some advanced maritime archaeological success in the region, such as the discovery of the Meido 4 cargo shipwreck from the 15th century, which yielded great insights into General Joseon shipbuilding.
But despite extensive searches, the ocean has not yielded a single piece of a Geobuxion.
However, the legacy is powerfully preserved through modern reconstructions.
You can see full-scale replicas currently anchored in Yeosu, in Tongyeong, and sitting on the grounds of the War Memorial in Seoul.
They were built to preserve the cultural and historical legacy of the Imjin War, allowing people to actually step inside the lower decks, see the rowing benches, and physically grasp the immense scale of the engineering required to make this work.
When we step back and analyze the life cycle of military technology, the Geobuxian serves as a perfect historical case study.
It was the absolute perfect key, engineered for a very specific lock.
But once the lock, the Japanese tactic of mass infantry boarding, was removed from the battlefield, the key naturally lost its primary value.
It's exactly like a highly specialized medical tool.
Right. A specific surgical laser might be highly effective for one specific type of rare surgery. It is absolutely life-saving in that exact context.
But it is far too expensive, difficult to maintain, and cumbersome for a doctor to use in general practice once that specific disease has been entirely eradicated.
You wouldn't drag it out for a routine checkup.
A very precise analogy. The fact that the ship eventually became obsolete does not diminish its brilliance in 1592. It merely reflects the constantly evolving nature of human conflict and naval warfare.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into the engineering and tactics of the Geobuxian, I want to leave you with a final concept to mull over.
When we study military history, we often focus on the biggest cannons or the thickest armor.
But the most decisive weapons in history are often not those that simply hit the hardest.
The truly decisive weapons are those that force an enemy to completely abandon their own preferred method of fighting.
The Geobuxian didn't just defeat the Japanese Navy. By its very structural design, by its spiked roof and flat hull, it made the Japanese way of war impossible to execute.
It neutralized their greatest strength, their samurai infantry, before a single sword was ever swung.
Thank you for listening. History Maps. Learn history visually.